Okay, so Jim and I have the task of explaining the friction, fracture, and earthquake physics program to you, which we also saddled with the unassuming title From the Atomic to the Tectonic. And I had told the chair of my department that this was the title of the program, and then we had a colleague of mine from civil engineering, Victor Lee, who some of you know, gave a talk in our department called From Nanostructure to Infrastructure. And my chair was very impressed that we had bracketed him in length scales. So, but as you might imagine, in a program of this type, no one person really works in all these fields on all these length scales. So we're going to do our best to sort of give you an overview of what the different issues are in these fields on these different length scales and where the areas of overlap are and why we thought that bringing people together in these various different communities at this time would be possibly lead to interesting collaborations and progress. So I was trying to think where a good place to start was, and it seemed like friction would be an auspicious place to start because every physical scientist pretty much has to take an intro physics course, and in the intro physics course you're taught about friction. So by starting with friction, I could have a common point of contact. Of course, for some of you, maybe that was a very, very long time ago, so I thought I'd start with a review. So when we think about friction, we start by thinking about some block on some surface, and our initial exposure to friction in our intro physics class is Amundsen's law. So we're taught that due to Amundsen's law that the frictional force is equal to some friction coefficient times the normal force, which is the force pushing down on this block. Now, Amundsen's law is very simple to write down, but it's actually, when you think about it, quite surprising because it has immediately in it the concept that the interaction between this body and the object on which it's sliding has nothing to do with the area of contact between those two bodies. So all that it depends on is this normal load that you're applying to the top of the body. And the typical reason that's given for this relationship is that if you were to look very carefully at this part of the material, you would note that there's some very rough surface on both sides, and that although the area of contact may look quite extended, that these only touch in some quite localized places. And so there's a real area of contact. That is independent of the actual area of contact, but that depends on the normal load. So the interesting thing is that Amundsen's law works for quite a wide variety of different kinds of materials. As you might expect, it doesn't work for all materials. It turns out that there's an important caveat if you have materials with significant amounts of cohesion between the surfaces. Then there's a form of the law due to Coulomb that also takes into account some effect, some linear effect on the actual contact area. So for materials that have adhesion between the surfaces, this may not be sufficient, but the relationship still holds for a wide class of materials. These were discovered empirically, yes. And actually, they were known. Amundsen worked around the turn 1699, 1700s. And these relationships were also known to Da Vinci from empirical observation. But of course, you know, this is what happens when you publish in Mirror Latin. You know, so there's another oddity that we're presented with in our intro physics exposure, which most people accept without any question because it's very in keeping with our common experience. And that is that there's not one friction coefficient, there are two friction coefficients, right? So we have some static friction and we have a dynamic friction. So, if we were to plot, say, frictional force versus sliding distance, then we have some force of static friction that we would experience at zero, and then we would jump down to some force of kinetic friction once we were able to break contact and begin to slide the block. And this area under the curve here would be the dissipation in sliding. But this is sort of an odd situation, right, for a number of reasons. First of all, you have a very discontinuous transition between these two modes of friction. And also, it's not even clear. I mean, we're given the fact that we can explain these with the same basic law, but it seems like on a physical basis, we're describing two very different things. In one case, we're describing what happens when two blocks are sitting in contact and begin to form some kind of bonding or interaction on the surface, and in the other case, we're talking about dissipation that's going on as we're sliding one thing on top of another. So the fact that those would both be controlled by the same friction law is not necessarily obvious. Well, it turns out that if you look at the empirical relations that exist in nature a little bit more closely than was available to Amontons in the 1700s, the situation is a bit more complex. So a more accurate representation of what one might expect between two materials in sliding would be that, yes, we would start off with some static friction, but then there would be some distance over which the material would weaken before we get to steady sliding. So this is known as linear slip weakening. And in this case, this area under this curve is what's often called the fracture energy. And it's basically describing the amount of energy that you need to break contact between this sliding block and the surface. Now, so this is sort of where we can get to with a sort of classical theory, but let's continue to explore what the limits of the classical theory are. So there are a couple of assumptions that are often put into the classical model of friction. One of those being that typically we assume that the friction is velocity independent. And another one being that we assume that somehow we can make this transition between the kinetic mode of sliding and the static mode of sliding instantaneously. So we slide our block along a table, we stop, and then suddenly we go back up to the static friction. So rehealing instantaneous. Now, in fact, this is neither of these are really the case. In terms of the velocity dependence of friction, the velocity dependence of friction turns out to be quite rich. So if we were to take some block and we were to slide it at velocity v1 for some time, we would have some initial frictional force. So this is again sliding distance. And now let's say at this distance we switch to another velocity v2 which was greater than v1. So typically what one would see in an experiment of this type is that you immediately get a jump in the force you feel. This is called the direct effect. Followed by a weakening to some lower friction coefficient. So we see both in fact, what we see is a direct effect followed by, in this case, velocity weakening, though you could also potentially see velocity strengthening. And a typical dependence is that it goes as minus the logarithm of the velocity. Now, the fact is that rehealing is also not seen to be instantaneous. If we sit and we have some block that's been sliding and we stop and then we wait for some time, what we see is that the static friction apparently goes as the logarithm of the waiting time, grows as the logarithm of the waiting time. So there's time dependence in the static friction. There's interesting velocity dependence in the kinetic friction. And none of these things are sort of captured in our classical presentation of friction that's typically taught to our undergrad. Yeah, no, so this can't go on forever, certainly. So, but this is, you know, for the range of measurements that can be made, this is a fairly typical observation. So one way that people who are working in the field and have attempted to address this is to create more sophisticated theories of what's going on during frictional sliding. And so a typical approach, which we'll call, call a rate and state model. And this, the one I'll describe is due to Rowena and Dietrich. So what we can do is we can write down an expression for our friction as a function of the velocity, but also of something, some history-dependent variable that's supposed to describe something about the state of our contact area. So we would have some initial frictional coefficient plus some dependence on the velocity plus some additional dependence on the state variable, which we'll call theta. And then the picture isn't complete unless we also describe what we think the history dependence of the contact is. So we would typically then write down some equation of motion for theta. And a typical form for this would be something like 1 minus v theta over dc. So we have a contact that grows in the absence of sliding, but that is cut off by some amount of sliding. So the steady state for the contact area is going to depend on the velocity at which you're sliding. So, and notice that we've also, like as from the observation in linear slip weakening, had to put in a length scale over which this weakening happens. Now at this point, you know, we've gotten into an interesting phenomenology. It's a phenomenology that can explain or describe some of these interesting rate effects. But we're left with this at this interesting point where we have an internal variable we've sort of made up that's supposed to describe something physical about the contact area. So the natural question to ask is, well, what does this state variable really describe? So well, there have been a number of experiments in plastics and glass that seem to indicate that theta does correspond quite closely to the real area of contact in those simple systems. So if we have two surfaces and we've roughened them and we put them into contact, we can measure the real area of contact during a sliding experiment, and it corresponds quite closely to theta. But the interesting thing is that these laws seem to work equally well in a number of systems which are much, much more complicated than that, such as rock sliding, in which you have lots of grit and dust and dirt in the interface. And so we remain with the question, why do these sorts of phenomenologies seem so general? And can we come up with a way to understand friction from a fundamental viewpoint to be able to describe what theta is in those more complex systems that are maybe of more interest? Now, what I'd like to do at this point is drop down to the atomic scale and ask, okay, well, how does this jibe with how we think about friction when we think about atoms? And it turns out that the situation becomes probably more confusing, not less. So okay, so if we think about some atomic scale slider on some atomic scale surface, okay, and we start pulling this, and we put a normal force on the slider. And for the moment, let's just assume that the only interaction between the slider and the surface is a repulsive force. So we're going to ignore cohesion for the moment. Well, then we could, for the moment, understand Amundsen's law and where the static friction coefficient comes from by realizing that as we begin to pull with our frictional force, and we can affect a displacement in the x direction, and that will cause a restoring force due to the repulsions from the atomic scale repulsions. And in order to accommodate the normal load, this slider will rise a bit until eventually, as you're doing work against the normal force, you reach a point where the entire system goes unstable. So if we look at the frictional force versus x, we eventually get to a point where we can't any longer accommodate the frictional force, and the system becomes unstable. So in this case, we can say, okay, well, maybe we can understand where the static friction is coming from. But there are a few things in this picture that seem grossly unrealistic. The first being that in very few cases would we really expect that our surface and our slider would have the same lattice parameter. In most cases, we would have a very different lattice parameter for our slider and for our substrate. And what that would imply is that as we were pulling, as many atoms were going up at any point as were going down. So there would not necessarily be any resistance to the frictional force if we had incommensurate surfaces. So the idea of static friction on an atomic scale is actually quite a special case. And in fact, it becomes even worse if you think about these surfaces in 2D, where you could even make systems that had the same lattice parameter incommensurate by infinitesimally small rotations. Yeah?
So does one actually experimentally very often see this? Because this kind of
structure, right,
you would expect you'd have huge sort of peaks and valleys on the atomic scale, and you wouldn't even be talking about things on the atomic scale for most substances or most surfaces.
Well, there are a couple of things about this. You mean this particular case, or you're talking?
The original picture you drew over there, you might expect, of course, the roughness is on scales much larger than the.
Right. Okay. So this is. Right, so why is this relevant? So that's, yeah, so the next point is, so why would you care for this behavior about this behavior? And it turns out that the reason that that is the case is because if we go back to look at our rough surfaces, and we say, well, what sort of description of the surface are we really talking about? Then for many engineering surfaces, we're talking about here roughness on all scales. So typically, these surfaces are well described by some fractal distribution of roughness, some power law distribution of roughness, which means that once you bring these two surfaces into contact, the actual area of contact, if you have two absolutely rigid surfaces, becomes a point set of measure zero. If you add in some elasticity or plastic deformation, you can correct for that. So you get some amount of area. But that amount of area is distributed in some fractal clusters on the surface that themselves are controlled by the smallest length scale, by the small length scale cutoff. So contact here is controlled So even though you have roughness on many scales, since we're mostly interested in the contact of asperities on the surface, and the size of those asperities is essentially controlled by the small length scale cutoff, this real area of contact is going to be distributed in essentially atomic scale contacts distributed along your surface.
So you're saying it's sort of points contacting in friction picture. But I'm wondering, you know, if you sort of look at a picture like that, I haven't thought much about friction, but if you look at a picture, you might think, well, one of those, you know, big points sticking down will get caught in a valley.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be the that catching could play an important role rather than sort of just point-to-point contact in this kind of picture.
Right. So, you're going to have some number of contacts for which you have a sort of, let's say, this kind of contact, and you're sliding this relative to that.
You're saying that's not dominant.
I'm saying that that for every, let's see. Right. So maybe this is idealized. So if we had something of this sort, then we have some small point. The point may be at some angle, but then you'll also have a number of angles that are at the other side that are also point-to-point contacts of that sort.
Also, Mike, is it the case that your picture is meant to be highly exaggerated?
Right. So this is, typically you're talking about roughnesses that are very small over very long distances. So, this is like when you look at a typical AFM picture, you typically exaggerate the vertical scale. So the distances that you're talking about traversing in the vertical direction aren't enough, through countering the normal force alone to account for the frictional force.
But when you add normal stress, doesn't it take you away from the point-to-point contact? So you start getting plastic yielding, and then it's really the larger scale roughness.
Right, but I think one of the interesting things in the plastic scale yielding case is that even though you start having plastic scale yielding, when you look at the detail of the contact surfaces that you form, they end up themselves being fractals of dimension less than 2. So you end up with a situation in which even though you've had the surfaces conform due to plastic yielding, you're not necessarily contacting on flat, atomically smooth surfaces of that sort. On surfaces that are, large on a macroscopic scale. So, okay. I think, So, at this point, I was going to make a transition to fracture, but I also want Jim to get a chance to talk. maybe I'll just quickly talk about the fracture case, and then I'll hand things over to Jim. So what does this have to do with the other topics, which are sort of fracture and failure in materials? So in the case of fracture, there's a lot that's known about fracture, particularly we can make some basic energetic arguments about fracture, and we can also examine fracture from a continuum elasticity viewpoint. And both of those provide a rather rich picture of what's going on in a fracturing solid. Probably the easiest introduction to this is the case in which you have something that's a strip that's fracturing along its length. And if you imagine the strip is infinitely long, then essentially what you're doing is you're sort of translating stressed material far ahead of the crack tip into fractured material far behind the crack tip. And this provides you with a sort of energy balance that the crack, it'll be energetically favorable for the crack to proceed as long as the amount of energy you're releasing in the far field ahead of the crack tip balances or exceeds the amount of energy you're having to put in to create surface. Well, if you go through that exercise, you end up with a sort of energy balance. So you'd say the change in energy is equal to 2 times the surface energy, here, times the thickness of the strip, times the change in distance of the crack. And that would be balanced by the width of the strip times its thickness times delta x, the stress squared over 2 times Young's modulus, the elastic modulus of the material. And what you'd find is that the critical stress for rupture is equal to something like square root 4e gamma over the width of the strip. Okay. So in this ideally brittle case, we can write down a relationship for what is the critical stress for this crack to proceed. But it turns out that in empirical measurements, you almost never find that the controlling energy is 2 gamma, is the energy to create surface creation, to create surface. So in reality, this is controlled by some fracture energy, which we call G, and G is typically much, much greater than 2 gamma. So it turns out that that's because typically in the vicinity of a crack tip there's some process zone. And in the process zone there are a large number of plastic, there's a large number of nonlinear things going on, like plastic deformation, that eat up a lot of energy. Right? So one way, yeah. Yes. So we can also analyze this problem elastically. And if we measure, analyze this problem elastically, what we find is that we would expect that we have a stress that grows as we approach the crack tip. So if we were to crack tip. So if we were to do an elastic solution of the stress outside the crack tip, since the crack tip is itself a singularity, we end up with a stress being proportional to one over the root of the distance from the tip of the crack, which implies that the stress is becoming infinitely high near the crack tip. Now, of course, that's not what really happens. In reality, something has to step in here close to the crack tip to cut off the stress, because materials can't maintain arbitrarily high stresses. So hence we end up with a process zone. But it turns out that this doesn't really keep you from using the elastic sorts of formalisms from analyzing a crack, because you can still note that there, in many cases, will be some zone outside here where this 1 over root r singularity persists. And as long as that's the case, then a theory known as linear elastic fracture mechanics holds, and you can do quite a bit of analysis about where a crack will move and what it will do. But it turns out for a number of problems, knowing what's going on in this process zone is critical. And those include understanding the direction. So for a dynamically moving crack, the direction of the crack, it also includes knowing how the fracture energy varies with the velocity, which is another important thing we would have to know if we were to predict what's going on in a dynamically moving crack. So the typical way in continuum mechanics formalism that's handled is by considering a crack and saying, okay, let's say that there are some tractions along the beginning of the crack in a region we'll call the cohesive zone, and saying that the traction across the cohesive zone decreases with the separation. So, in a sense, this looks a lot like our friction laws, in that we have to prescribe at what traction will this begin to open, and then how will the energy be lost as we start separating the two surfaces of the crack. So there are some immediate analogies that one can draw between fracture and friction. Right, so the idea is that this then, since this is prescribing all the nonlinear behavior of your material, would have to include things like plastic deformation and flow, activation of microcracks, anything that was going on a scale, on a small scale that was cutting off your elastic singularity. Okay. Okay, so there are a number of issues that we have in trying to construct these sorts of cohesive models, because you need to put in cohesive models of this sort if you want to predict where your crack is going to go and what speed it's going to go at. And those include the fact that, in general, we again have to introduce some kind of cutoff length scale here, similar to what happened in the friction law. In addition, there may be internal time scales. Associated with separation that we would need to put in order to effectively predict the direction of the crack. And another issue being that there's a critical traction here. And typically, the critical traction is typically far less than the force needed to break bonds. So there's a desire to come up with some sort of theory that can understand why we can have a cutoff stress, essentially due to this cohesive model, but still transmit stress to the crack tip in a way that will cause bond breaking at the crack tip and cause the crack to proceed. Now, in addition for understanding a dynamically moving crack, there are additional issues, which is that here we are regularizing this nonlinear zone by saying that we can sort of compress it all onto the boundary, and the boundary that's along the direction in which the crack is moving. But in general, it was shown early on in the fracture mechanics literature that once the crack begins to move dynamically, the maximum stresses are not necessarily along the midline of the crack, that they can be along directions far off the midline of the crack. And if that's the case, then it's not clear that putting all the yielding onto a zone that's along the crack necessarily captures all the interesting plastic deformation that's going on in the crack zone, unless you have a severely weakened crack. Okay, so there have been some physics approaches to try and put this sort of fracture mechanics, have a sort of lattice version of fracture mechanics that could be compared to the linear elastic fracture mechanics and hopefully bring a sort of physics viewpoint onto fracture. And there have also been several attempts to map phase field type models that have been successful in understanding first order phase transitions onto the fracture problem. And so I think there are fundamental physics questions as to how far one can go with that analogy between a first order phase transition and a crack. But I think this is a sort of overview of what sorts of problems in fracture and friction that we're discussing in the program, and I think I'd like to leave some time for Jim to talk about the earthquake aspects of the program. Well, as Michael has pointed out, this program has brought together a really diverse group of people working on a very wide range of problems, and what unites is kind of interest in how things slide and how things break. I'll try to give you an earthquake physics perspective on this. It's my perspective, and of course others probably have different views on it. I think there are two characteristics that, or maybe more even, about what some characteristics of the earthquake problem that are worth mentioning. First of all is the vast range of scales. I'm sure you all know that we can have big earthquakes where we have rupture-like processes that will cover 1,000 kilometers or more. Those are rare events happening maybe only once every 50 years or so on the Earth. And on a daily basis, we may have hundreds of fracture events, you know, on the scale of this room, even just in California. So there's a huge range of scales and a huge range of time scales to worry about. The strain accumulation process is measured in years or centuries. The stress release process in an earthquake is measured in seconds, so in small events, milliseconds. So there's some scaling issues and how to move from one scale to the next, and some perhaps are not quite as straightforward as we think or would like to have them to be. The other thing, and I think it's already illustrated by Michael's talk, is what we're really dealing with is system behavior in almost everything we talk about, not so much the elemental characteristics, but how these characteristics work together. And geologic systems are really messy systems. They're probably as messy as they get. So one challenge in all of this, in trying to develop any theories of how fracture, friction, and earthquakes is kind of what to abstract out, what to throw away, and what to keep to try to build some useful and predictive models. Any other general thoughts? I guess one other comment I'd make is that, as you may have gathered, we still don't have a good view of or a good understanding of a lot of the governing equations that control these systems. So the issue of how do they go together, but we don't understand a lot of the fundamental behavior that we want to go into it. It's useful to divide this in earthquake processes into, at least for the point of this discussion, I think into three kind of topics. The first is earthquake nucleation, and I'll describe it in a minute. The second is earthquake rupture dynamics. And then there's the seismicity, and seismicity is kind of the collection of earthquakes in space and time. So it's kind of the overall system dynamics. They're all related, of course, but traditionally we kind of look at these separate categories, and they involve some different problems. So let's start with nucleation. I think the early concepts of earthquakes, Michael mentioned this with a plot that disappeared with the displacement weakening friction, is that you have these faults in the earth, the stress is increasing, slowly increasing, the stress reaches a critical point, rupture starts, nucleation, initiation process is not that interesting. A single threshold stress at which earthquakes occur. Well, I think what we discovered in the laboratory with these effects that are kind of lumped under rate and state friction, and I'm convinced apply to nature. It may not be the complete story, but at least they're a partial story, is that there's not a threshold stress. There's a range of stresses under which failure can occur. Within that range of stresses, the time to instability is a time-dependent process. The earthquake, or the slip instability initiation process, is highly time-dependent and highly stress-dependent within that range of stresses. And so one, I think, success of kind of this rate and state dependent formulation is that this provided a model for which we could look at earthquake nucleation. And it's been pretty well established that that's what holds in the laboratory, and holds quite closely to what you would expect here. One aspect of this, and if I have time I'll get to it, but I'm not sure we will, is that using the rate and state dependent formulation, we've developed some models of time dependent, stress dependent earthquake nucleation. And those models have some predictive ability. Earthquakes have a minimum size. There's a critical dimension over which earthquakes can nucleate. Below that, the sliding is always stable. They have a minimum size, perhaps. It's probably the size of this desk. They provided a model for things like foreshocks, aftershocks, triggering between earthquakes, stress transfer between earthquakes, and then maybe it's some things that aren't quite so obvious. One theory that comes up at least once a year is tidal triggering of earthquakes. Earth tides occur; they occur. Their stresses in the you can measure the stresses, and so there must be a really strong correlation between earthquakes and tides. Problem is, there's not. And the issue goes back to this parameter right here, and that introduces a viscous delay in the system, and this nucleation process is so strongly self-driven that these small tidal fluctuations just don't even affect. Once this nucleation process gets started, and it may go on for a year or more, It pays attention to itself and not so much the external influences. We may have time to get into that a little bit more if people are interested. Okay, well, for areas kind of looking ahead to the future, Michael has mentioned that these rate and state laws are, they seem to be quite universal, and not just for friction. Even intra crystalline deformation of certain types follows these rate and state laws. Granular materials, we don't really have a good understanding of the mechanics of them, what the underlying physics is of this. And one can't help but think, or at least hope, that if we had a better physical understanding, we could really do a lot better theoretically and build those models. So that's certainly one hope. And another perhaps more modest hope that I think people will be talking about some during this session is granular flow. And we see rate and state effects in granular materials. They're well satisfied by those laws, and yet even phenomenologically we don't have a good idea of what's controlling. It's probably contact processes, nonlinear contact processes, and current granular models just don't have those in them. So I think there's a real opportunity for making some progress there. I'm watching my time. I think I'll move to earthquake rupture propagation. For those of you that caught Ralph Orchuleta's lecture last week on this kind of introduction to earthquakes and that, he gave a really, really good coverage of earthquake rupture propagation, so I won't spend too much time on it. It's a terribly important subject. We need good predictive models of earthquake rupture propagation. They're of interest, I think, for the science. What are in what conditions do ruptures run? What's the source time function of the slip along fault surfaces? What makes them stop? But they're of great practical importance. This building we're inhabiting right now was built with design criteria based on predictions of what earthquake ground motions are likely to be in big earthquakes. The reality is we have precious few earthquake ground motions in close to large earthquakes. The few that exist at more moderate distances show a lot of scatter, so we don't understand what the source of variability in them is. And for quite a few years, we're going to be relying on theory to tell us how earthquakes behave and what kind of ground motions we can expect from them. And so there's quite a bit of effort in this area. I think one of the more interesting problems that
is looming on the horizon with earthquake ruptures relates to the geometry of faults. This has become a topic of some interest to me. Virtually all of our theories are based on mathematically planar fault surfaces for obvious reasons. You know, that's tractable. But in fact, faults in nature are best described as a random fractal surface with roughness. And in addition to that, they're not continuous. They step over. They form networks at all different scales. And a slip on such faults introduces a geometric element of heterogeneity and complexity that's really not been explored. And it introduces, I believe, a whole new dimension to this idea of trying to work out the energy budget for fracture processes. In the kind of classical fracture mechanics literature, we have a traction-free surface here. An earthquake fault, if a rupture runs along this fault, it's sliding mismatched materials along. Probably other secondary faults are being activated and dissipating energy. That mismatch is pumping strain energy into the medium, which is not being pumped in here. So in many ways, we don't understand what the energy budget is for earthquake mechanics. And I think that's going to be a really productive area of work and of some interest in the future. I'm just going to keep skimming along here. Let me just see if there's any points here we should mention. Oh yes, I really should. This is important. One aspect of earthquake rupture dynamics are the sliding conditions along fault surface. Now in the laboratory, I think we have a pretty good empirical basis for doing modeling. But these are the slips that occur in our little laboratory earthquakes are typically a tenth of a millimeter. We can slide at maybe centimeters a second in most experiments. In earthquakes, slip can reach meters per second. The total slip, well, in the Sumatran earthquake that occurred this last December, slip was 20 meters. And it probably at any one location probably occurred in just a few seconds. So there are a number of processes that are probably going on faults, or happening on faults, that we're just not building into our models, at least with any consistency yet. And one is thermal effects. Jim Rice has been working recently, and he gave a nice talk at our meeting 2 weeks ago. Thermal effects could come in several ways. One is by flash heating at points of contact, which are going to weaken the contacts and kind of weaken the frictional of the material. It appears to be a real effect and one that needs to be taken into account. The second one is just gross melting. If you look at the energetics of these big earthquakes and the width, I'll back up. I've been talking and we always talk about faults as being frictional surfaces, but in fact if you go in and look at them, the slip occurs over some width of pulverized material. We call it fault gouge. But if you look at the zone over which all that strain is being dissipated, you would expect in large earthquakes that you would have gross melting of quite a thick zone whenever that happens. You do see melting in some, evidence of melting along some faults, but it's very, very rare. So there's some processes here that are going on that we don't understand for weakening of the faults, or they're occurring at a lower stress than we anticipate. There's just some big gaps in our knowledge here. Another weakening mechanism it relates to heating again is pore fluid interactions. I mentioned these systems are messy. Well, these are rocks. The rocks are saturated, the pores, cracks are saturated with fluids in the earth. And if you have heating, the thermal expansion of water is greater than rocks, so you'll get pressurization of the fluids in the fault zone. That can re- that can reduce the effective normal stress that's pushing them together. It could be a very important effect in large earthquakes that's just kind of not evident in kind of these smaller scale theories. And there's some recent laboratory experiments that other exotic things may happen. Terry Tullis at Brown University, sliding silicate rocks for a large distance, finds extreme weakening. Coefficient of friction drops from its normal universal value of about 0.6 for almost all rocks, drops down to about 0.1 with large displacements. And it appears to be due to the formation of silica gel, very transient effect of silica gel on the surfaces in this human environment. It's an amorphous material and disappears very rapidly, but it's enough with large displacements, with this grinding of rocks of the silica into very fine particles to perhaps cause weakening. So there's some interesting phenomenon that our models aren't even kind of coming close to dealing with yet. Just about out of time here, but I will mention seismicity. And so this is kind of the collective behavior of earthquakes. It's the system level behavior of fault networks. I'll just return to the point I made before. Most of our theories treat faults as a single entity in isolation as planar surfaces. And they're none of those things. They always occur in networks. You cannot go out and find a single fault. You always find a collection of faults. It's very true that there's along a fault system like the San Andreas, there's a zone which has most of the slip. But whenever an earthquake occurs, or whenever you go out and look, there's all kinds of other faults there. And so, how do these faults interact? And what do we want to model with them? I think we want to model seismicity in space and time. This is getting at kind of the dream of earthquake prediction in a part. But short of that, there are a lot of empirical phenomenon to kind of base a modeling effort on. There are two great empirical laws of seismicity. The first is the Gutenberg-Richter magnitude-frequency relationship. This is a power law relationship between earthquake size and frequency. And since earthquake magnitudes are on a logarithmic scale, if you don't know, roughly speaking, for every magnitude 8 earthquake, you have 10 magnitude 7s and 100 magnitude 6s, and so on. So that's a very robust observation that's seen worldwide with seismicity. And there's been efforts on modeling that. And there are really, I guess, kind of three families of explanations for this. You're looking at a process which involves a wide range of fracture sizes, so there's some kind of heterogeneity in the system. Well, one possibility, and this kind of is, I think, inherited from the idea of a single fault and seismicity occurring on a single fault, is that there's a dynamical process. There's a dynamical roughening of stresses that occurs just in the intrinsic dynamics of earthquake occurrence, which roughens the stresses on a fault, and that gives rise to this wide range of earthquake magnitudes. A second category is, I mentioned that these faults have a fractal roughness. That means that even if you have uniform slip on these faults, you'll have a fractal distribution of stress that emerges just from the mismatch, just along that single fault. And that's a very strong heterogeneity, in my opinion, and so we can get Gutenberg-Richter out of that without question. The third proposal is that people have mentioned and discussed in the literature is that these fault systems have very strong self-similar characteristics. I've drawn an idealized fault system on this board here, and this could be the San Andreas, some plate boundary of San Andreas fault, or it could be a little fracture system right here on the scale of the room here. So the idea is that earthquakes are controlled by the size of the fault on which they occur. And we have a power law distribution of fault sizes, and so there's really no big issue about Gutenberg-Richter. Reflects the underlying geometry. What I take away from this is that, well, maybe Gutenberg-Richter is not too diagnostic of that. And so what are some other laws that we might look at? The second great empirical law for seismicity is Omori's law, which is Omori's law of aftershock decay. At the time of a main shock, or immediately following a main shock, the local seismicity in a region can jump by as much as by a factor of 10 to the fifth. Huge increase in the rates of earthquake occurrence. And there are a number of models for aftershocks. I prefer mine. And it's based on rate and state friction, and it's based on this time-dependent nucleation. And what we observe is, just from rate and state friction, is that, as I said, there's this range of stresses. And it's a fairly simple, I guess, statistical model with a little bit of physics in it. I won't call it a statistical physics model, in which we assume some distribution of initial conditions on nucleation sources. I selected a distribution such that if we're loading a region steadily at a constant rate, then there'll be some steady state seismicity rate that occurs from that. So that gives us a way to get a distribution of conditions. Now if we perturb that by suddenly jumping the stress, an earthquake occurred nearby, we hear, then we immediately get something that looks just like Omori's law out of it. In fact, I'll write Omori's law here for you. More advised, it's just that rate of earthquake activity goes by something like this, sometimes with a exponent here, but around one. The rate and state formulation for earthquake rates is as follows, and you might note that earthquake rate normalized by some background rate is just 1 over different gamma. So there's some variable here, and sigma. So S is stress. In this particular case, it's a Coulomb stress. It's a measure of failure stress, scalar measure of stress. S dot R is just the stressing rate at which you observe the background rate. So it's a fairly simple looking formulation. You might note that it has the same form as that, although there was quite a few number of steps to get from that to this. And when you solve this for a stress step, you can get something like this, and it turns out that A is just equal to R, B is equal to the and T, in order to make the dimensions work out, this is really T over a normalizing time, where T sub A is equal to this. Right here. So we have a fairly simple model for aftershocks with this really huge jump in earthquake rates with a stress step. And the interesting thing is that if you put in the stress changes, I mentioned tidal triggering. If the stress change here is 1 MPa, you can get like a 100,000-fold increase in earthquake rates. If you put in a thousandth of an MPa, which is characteristic of tidal stresses, you get something like a 0.5% change of earthquake rates over a tidal cycle. And if you look at just kind of Poisson statistics, what you will come up with is that it's going to take something like 20,000 earthquakes. You have to monitor 20,000 earthquakes before you can begin to see a tidal signal appearing from the background noise. So we have something of a of a kind of a statistical model for seismicity, but it does not really address this issue of what's going on in fault systems and that. And there are a number of challenges to this. I'm running over time. I'm sorry. I'll just mention a couple of them because they might be of interest. One might be of interest for some of the mathematicians in the audience. And that is that in order to study this problem, we have to be able to describe it. And I know of no tools in which that really describe this kind of self-similar fault network geometry. So, let alone, so it's hard to do theory on something that you can't even, an entity you can't describe. And I don't know of any way of even describing these things. So I believe there's kind of some fundamental work that could be done on these branched fault networks with differing amounts of slip.
Stochastic branching?
Well, these things don't form at random. Every fault is there for a reason. They work collectively to accommodate the deformation in a region. And it would be, I think, a nice and useful thing to have a tool which with a few parameters hopefully could really describe the geometric characteristics of something like this. The other side of it is that we don't really even know how to generate these things. It's hard to generate them, put it that way. It's hard to generate them just in order to even do studies on them. I'll stop there. Sorry we went so long. Yep, it does. It does, yes. And typically with a large dam, there are two possible effects. One is the direct loading, the weight of the dam. And in that case, you have crustal loads that are on the order of MPa. They're comparable to a 1 megapascal, sorry, or 10 atmospheres pressure. So 30 feet of water is 1 atmosphere, roughly. So 300 feet of water, big reservoir. And they do trigger earthquakes, apparently directly by just their weight, but also through the fluid pressure effect of increasing the fluid pressure underneath them.
Debate in the op-ed pages whether the Sumatra earthquake was an aftershock of the very large earthquake in Antarctica a few weeks earlier or something.
Yeah.
How can you even refer to such a question? Can you?
It's hard to. I mean, of course, the definition of aftershocks is the operational definition of aftershocks is that it's they occur within some zone, within some time, and if you pick the size of a zone that's near the main shock, then you get something like Omori's law out of it. But it's interesting. Statistically, we can make statements now just by looking at earthquake pairs and a rule of thumb that might be useful to any of you here is that if you feel an earthquake within a week, there's something like a 1 in 10 chance that you're going to feel another earthquake of equal or larger size. And that's kind of foreshock statistics, but also it also obeys the same Omori's law kind of behavior. The biggest risk is within a few minutes after the first shaking. The business of distant triggering of earthquakes, I think 15 years ago people would have laughed it off. But with the Landers earthquake in California, it produced a phenomenon that seismicity lit up to some extent over the entire western U.S. and particularly in geothermal areas, perhaps. But and if you do the elasticity calculation, the stresses, tidal stresses, look giant compared to the stresses you're going to get, the static stresses you'll get. And the explanation is that the seismic waves don't attenuate with distance as fast, and the kind of the the common explanation of it is it's like wrapping a window with a hammer. The seismic waves went out and it kind of broke some important bonds in the system. And again, you can get at that with this. And you know, it predicts that you would see some slight increase, perhaps.
Okay, well, I think we're all today. We hope to hear again from this program in 3 weeks. And I hope you guys will hurry up. Go out near where I live. Sycamore Canyon Road has been closed. And the mountain is moving. They say it's due to the rains last fall. Okay.
Well, wrap up for today.